You're listening to Labor Express, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. News for working people by working people. I'm your host, Jeremy Lucero, and this is the Sunday, March 2nd, 2008 edition of Labor Express. On tonight's program, we're going to take a look at recent developments in Iraq. Well, the mainstream press has spent a great deal of time in recent months repeating the Bush administration's propaganda about the success of the so-called surge strategy. The reality for working people in Iraq, especially those that are involved in the effort to build a secular, non-sectarian society there, is quite different. On February 12th, the U.S. occupation forces once again raided and ransacked the headquarters of the Iraq Freedom Congress, or the IFC. The IFC is the leading organization in Iraq calling for an end to the U.S. occupation and also an end to the domination of ethnic and religious-based political parties in that country's history since the post-Saddam Hussein era. U.S. troops and Iraqi government forces have continually harassed and tried to suppress the IFC. On tonight's program, we'll hear from Amjad Al-Jawari, who's the North American representative of the IFC. He'll talk about this latest attack and about the reality of life for the average Iraqi in Iraq today. But first, we have this week's Labor News Highs from WIN, Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
And I'm Jesse Russell. A June 3rd hearing has been set in federal court to consider final approval of the Retiree Health Care Trust Fund negotiated by the United Auto Workers at General Motors. Doug Cunningham has this report.
The United Auto Workers has taken federal legal action needed to implement the VEBA Health Care Trust for GM UAW retirees. The UAW says the trust fund will be managed by independent trustees with expertise in health care and investments. If approved by the U.S. District Court in Eastern Michigan, the proposed settlement filed by the UAW and retirees will establish the Health Trust Fund to pay for health care benefits for current and future UAW GM retirees. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger has reiterated his previous comment that the UAW is confident this VEBA Trust Fund will have enough money to pay for retiree health care for 80 years. Any modifications to union retiree benefits cannot be finalized at the bargaining table. Court approval is needed. 11 trustees will manage the VEBA, 5 appointed by the UAW, and 6 public trustees. GM will keep paying for retiree health benefits until January 1st of 2010, when the VEBA takes over.
After a contentious labor campaign, nurses at Parkview Community Hospital in Riverside, California, voted to join the United Nurses Association of California and Union of Healthcare Professionals. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
Parkview's 260 registered nurses were elated over news of their win after having endured ongoing intimidation and harassment in the months leading up to the elections, says ER nurse Don Griffin.
Oh, I think it's great. It's very, I think it's a big step forward for Parkview.
While UNEC officials didn't say how many voted in support of labor representation in the elections that took place earlier this month, they say a majority of the nurses supported the union drive. Laureen Lazarevich is spokeswoman for UNAC.
They're very excited that they were able to choose courage over fear and overcome many obstacles, and they're very excited about going into contract negotiations.
With union elections behind them, nurses will now enter contract negotiations, where they will have to sort out the most basic needs of the hospital. For Workers Independent News, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
At least 48 million Americans lack high enough incomes to realize the American dream of solid middle-class lives. That's according to a new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The report says 1 in 5 U.S. workers earn wages below a minimum middle-class standard. To get into the middle class, you have to have a good job, defined by the Center for Economic and Policy Research as jobs paying at least $17 an hour, with employer-sponsored health benefits and employer-sponsored retirement plans. Just under 1/4 of all U.S. jobs meet this definition of good jobs. The report calls for a new social contract in America to lift workers into the middle class. It includes reforming and enforcing wage and hour standards and making sure workers can exercise their collective bargaining union rights. The report also calls for developing new labor standards that include guaranteed paid sick days, paid vacation and paid family and medical leave in the U.S., as well as true universal health care. Merger talks are all the rage in the airline industry, but where do the unions representing workers come down? Jesse Russell takes a look.
While pilots spent Thursday and Friday of last week trying to work out differences over a merger between Northwest and Delta Airlines, the International Association of Machinists, representing Northwest baggage handlers, said it would oppose the two players coming together. In a statement, the IAM said airline mergers traditionally hurt passengers and workers alike. The pilots at both airlines are represented by the Airline Pilots Association, but the sticking point on their end is how the seniority list at the two airlines will be combined. The union wants to make sure that the merger agreement benefits all pilots involved. Meanwhile, many of United's mechanics are represented by the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association. Joe Prisco, president of AMFA Local 9, told the San Mateo County Times that if the airlines try something bad for the employees, the unions will take the fight to the streets. Local 9 represents workers at a maintenance base in San Francisco, which the airline has said could be closed or reduced if there is a merger.
Crandall Canyon mine owner Robert Murray has been subpoenaed to appear before a House committee, Jesse Russell reports.
Last year, the world watched as the tragic events at Utah's Crandall mine unfolded. Six miners and three rescue workers perished during the incident, and when the U.S. House Education and Labor Committee held hearings shortly thereafter to investigate, mine co-owner Robert Murray refused to voluntarily make an appearance. At the time, committee chairman George Miller vowed that he would continue to pursue the investigation.
But let me be very clear, this committee will not be deterred from getting all of the information we need to do our independent investigation. We will not tolerate obstruction and delay by either the department or by the company in pursuit of that information and this investigation.
Now, the committee has subpoenaed Murray to appear so they can ask him about his company's use of a controversial mining method called retreat mining. Mining experts advise against the use of that type of mining because it requires the removal of unmined coal pillars that are used as support in the mine. The Mine Safety and Health Administration had approved the use of retreat mining in Crandall Canyon. Murray has denied that retreat mining was involved in the collapse and has insisted that an earthquake was at fault.
The California Labor Federation and ACORN are backing a bill that would guarantee paid sick leave to all workers in the state. Jeremy Smith is a legislative advocate for the federation.
This has already been passed in San Francisco, so we know that it can work, that it does work, and that our studies have shown that it's supported by a great many people in California.
About 6 million California workers, roughly 40% of the state's workforce, have no paid sick days. Maine, Ohio, and Washington, D.C. are also considering guaranteeing paid sick leave. The UAW is on strike against American Axle and Manufacturing in Michigan and in New York. 3,600 workers hit the picket lines on Tuesday. The company is attacking wages and benefits, demanding a $14 an hour pay cut and elimination of future retiree health care. It also wants to wipe out defined benefit pensions for active workers. The UAW says such deep sacrifices can't be expected from workers without offering something substantial in return. The United States is approaching a crisis point when it comes to public health workers. Jesse Russell reports.
A new report from the Association Schools of Public Health has some startling statistics about the future of the U.S. public health workforce. By the year 2020, the country will need an estimated 250,000 more public health workers. Over the 10 years between 1980 and the year 2000, the workforce lost 50,000 workers, leaving fewer resources to deal with a growing population. According to the report, by the year 2012, 23% of the current workforce will be eligible to retire. That amounts to nearly 110,000 workers. The study by the association lays out ways to avert a crisis in the public health sector. They suggest an increase in funding for professional education. In order to keep up, schools of public health will need to train three times as many students over 12 years as they are currently. Schools also need to encourage capacity growth to allow for a larger graduate-level student body. Also, it is suggested by the organization that the United States form a global health service that can coordinate U.S. efforts to assist in international areas of need.
The FMPR, a union representing 42,000 striking Puerto Rican teachers, is officially decertified. An appellate court upheld that decertification. The teachers went on strike after 30 months of bargaining proved fruitless. The Puerto Rican Secretary of Education says there will be no further contract talks under any circumstances. Puerto Rican teachers are paid more than $19,000 less than teachers in any U.S. state, despite the fact that the cost of living is generally higher in Puerto Rico than it is in the U.S. The Service Employees International Union is pouring resources into the Democratic presidential primaries on behalf of Barack Obama in Ohio and in Texas. SEIU has spent at least $1.4 million so far and will spend more time and money reaching out to its members to vote for Obama. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, the SEIU is endorsing Al Franken to be the Democratic Farmer Labor Party candidate for U.S. Senate. In order to win the Democratic nomination, Franken must be endorsed by DFL delegates in the party's convention in June and then win a primary election in order to face incumbent Republican Senator Norm Coleman in November. Registered nurses in Wisconsin are asking that the state legislature ban mandatory overtime. Jesse Russell reports from Madison.
At a hearing on Wednesday concerning SB 512, a bill before the Wisconsin State Senate, six registered nurses expressed why the state needs to step in and ban mandatory overtime at hospitals. In concept, mandatory overtime is only supposed to be used in extreme situations. But according to the nurses on Wednesday, overtime has been increasingly used at Wisconsin hospitals to fill permanent holes in staffing schedules. As a result, nurses are fatigued and overworked, resulting in dangerous situations for patients, as well as lower morale in a profession already seeing a shortage of workers. Ann Louise Tetrault is a registered nurse at the University of Wisconsin Hospital.
Don't have nurses telling stories to their children, to their friends, that I had to stay and I'm not able to do this, or I put my patient in jeopardy. This cannot be what we do in healthcare to our patients.
The Wisconsin Senate is expected to vote on the bill Wednesday.
The first ever online rally for paid sick days launches today, sponsored by the National Partnership for Women and Families. 57 million American workers have no paid sick days. Today's online rally for paid sick days is in support of the Healthy Families Act, federal legislation that would guarantee workers up to 7 paid sick days a year. You can join the rally online at everyonegetsick.org.
Here is today's economic report. Is your mortgage higher than the worth of your home? According to a new study by Moody's, nearly 8.8 million homeowners hold mortgages that have outpaced the value of their homes. That's roughly 10% of all U.S. homeowners. The result is a large selling off of homes at a time when the market is already glutted with empty housing. As a result, any recovery hoped for by economists in the housing market could be prolonged.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And you're listening to Labor Express Radio, news for working people by working people. And that was this week's Labor News Highlights from WIN, Workers' Independent News. I want to thank WIN for allowing us to broadcast their material, and I want to encourage our listeners to check out the WIN website, which is www.laborradio.org. You can also find a link to the WIN website on our website, which is www.laborexpress.org. Just a few comments on some of the news items on tonight's WIN segment. You heard there about the UAW strike against American Axle. We've made much in the past few months of the disastrous concessionary contracts that the UAW signed with the big three U.S. automakers last fall. But, of course, we can never give up hope that the labor movement might turn things around. And this strike at American Axle has already gone on longer than the strikes at either GM or Chrysler back in the fall. So one could only hope that the UAW is making some kind of a stand here. But, you know, the issues in this strike are much the same as they were with the big three, talking about cutting the salaries of new workers, talking about issues with their with the health care and with the retirement benefits and so on. It's kind of hard to imagine that the UAW would give in as they did with the big three and then try to stop this concessionary flood or onslaught, if you will, with American Axle. Indeed, the fact that the company was allowed to stockpile so many parts in preparation for the strike is a bad sign. Smart strike preparation tactics call for a work-to-rule campaign prior to any kind of strike that could help keep those stockpiles to a minimum so that the company can't rely on those stockpiles during a prolonged strike. So it's concerning, but certainly I want to offer my fellow UAW members the most emphatic statement of solidarity. We're definitely looking to all of you to save our collective asses. So good luck to you guys out there. Also, in the WIN's coverage of the decertification vote of the Independent Puerto Rican Teachers Union, They failed to mention that it was the treachery of some of the officials in SEIU in league with the government of Puerto Rico that led to the breaking of that teacher strike and to the decertification vote. We'll try to get more details on this on an upcoming episode of the program, but SEIU is very much tied into that. They're basically raiding this union. And it's just another example, I think, unfortunately, of the bizarre, rather bizarre, negative and destructive turn that SEIU has taken in recent years. We desperately need some serious reform in that union. We're excited to hear about reform efforts going on in SEIU, and we'll definitely be addressing that issue on upcoming episodes of the program as well. Well, last month was, of course, African-American History Month, and I must apologize that besides some music breaks that we had on a few programs that had an African-American theme, we had no programs explicitly addressing issues of African-Americans in the labor movement this past month. We usually do try to air a program or two during the month, taking a look at issues or the history of the black working class in the U.S., but we did fail to do so this year, and I do apologize for that. You know, if there's one clear example in the last half decade of the persistence of deep racism in our society, it has to be the events surrounding the Hurricane Katrina disaster. This ongoing, mostly man-made tragedy highlights so many examples of the continuing race divide and racist oppression that goes on in our nation. So perhaps in a form of an inadequate apology for not having had something of more substance during African American History Month, I'm going to offer this audio recollection of the tragedy by music artist Professor Louie. This is kind of a Gil Scott Heron-esque type poem set to words, and it was played on the January 28th episode of Building Bridges radio program at WBAI in New York City.
And now, Katrina's winds of disaster still howl with Professor Louie.
It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? You and me, we saw the pictures on TV. Judgment Day on land and sea, we saw the proof. Water rising to the roof. People in the attic, dead face down. Couldn't even get outside to drown. Raw sewage, toxic waste. Little kids scuffling for a place to lie down. Couldn't pay for a way to get out of town. They tried and cried for a ride they never got. School bus rusts in the parking lot. Motherless children forced to roam. No home but the floor of the Superdome. As we gaze through the haze, we saw who pays. Black bodies laying in the streets for days. In so many ways, disease and trash. Fire and brimstone, smoke and ash. National Guard at the door of the store. M16s all over. Where was the war? Many thousand gone. Does it mean what it seems? Judgment Day in New Orleans. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? Now the Mississippi River rolls into town, right out the heartland from Minnesota down. Wheat, soy, cotton, and corn. Multinational agriculture, sure as you're born. Then Kraft, Nabisco, General Mills. Take the grain from the plains and hills. And down in Louisiana, the chemical plants come to the river like ants in your pants. Petrochemicals for miles and miles. Toxic waste in piles and piles. Down there in the Mississippi Valley, the people call it Cancer Alley. Ships through the night, the headlight beams. Billions in goods to the port of New Orleans. And these giant companies held the keys to government subsidies, tax cuts and incentives. And they were very inventive. They changed the river flow, killed the wetlands below. The hurricane had a new place to go. And they made so much money, it got kind of heavy. But they never spent the money to fix the levee on the white side. The water stayed down. They never fixed the levee on the black side of town. So before and after, like slave and master, this was a man-made disaster. You could blame the hurricane, but that's kind of a joke. The people died 'cause the levee broke. And in all the flood and deluge, all the blood you saw on the news. Where were the boats, the cars and buses, the food, water, doctors and nurses? Where were the cops and the army? I'll tell you calmly, front to back, Jack, the army was in Iraq. The Department of Homeland Security, here to protect you and me, waited 3 days before they'd even say it was an emergency. There was no urgency there. They didn't care because it was poor people left behind to die. And if you don't mind, it's no lie. It wasn't that kind to also leave alone the people in the prisons and the nursing homes. So there was blood on the leaves and blood at the root, and death and destruction wearing a business suit. And there is no doubt when the people need it, they couldn't get out. And right now, Jim, we begin the next big sin. When the people need it, they can't get back in. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? So from under the hell of the smell and the human waste, from under the dying and the sewer grates, from under the wreckage, the rats crept through. Some had 4 legs, some had 2. The president flew in his private jet, and people noticed he hadn't been there yet. So days and days late, he stood by the gate in Jackson Square. TV cameras filled the air. He put on some pretty good acts, but we now know the facts. He gave no bid contracts to Halliburton, Kellogg Brown, his whole clientele. $1 billion companies, he wished them well. All his friends had something to sell. Now the storm had passed. At last it was sunny. So from people dying, they made money. Trailers wasting in the sun. Millions for work that was never done. The same ones who caused the disaster. Out of the ash, trash, and plaster. Out of the crucifixion morgues where the people lie. Before the bodies were dry. Those who let the levee crumble and didn't grumble or stumble. But those who committed the sin watched the money roll in. And we heard them right. They told us in plain sight. This place is gonna be more white. Condos and co-ops, hotels and photo ops, all enforced by thousands of cops. So the big money came back. But if you're poor or black, you got a one-way ticket on a one-way track. Clickety-clack, hear the engines roar. It's a pity, but your own city can't use you no more. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? So the heart and soul of the USA is getting down in the town of New Orleans today. The art of the music in your heart got its start on the Mississippi shore. Blues, gospel, jazz, throw wide the door. Buddy Bolden and Louis Armstrong. There is no way that they were wrong. So black and blue, you still hear the song. How long? Tell me, Lord, how long? To save your soul on a Saturday night, to open your eyes to see the light through the flood and corruption, the blood and guts. What happens to New Orleans? It happens to us. What's in your ear, loud and clear? New Orleans, it's right here. If greed and money is number one, there'll never be enough for everyone. It's already begun right here today. Throw out everyone who can't pay. A real estate boom, $200,000 a room. You try to be decent and give, and in the place you're born, you can't afford to live. But through the rain sound, through the hurricane, we found thieves and killers in charge. And there is no doubt, we are the only ones who can take them out. No matter where you roam, no one lives alone. We need a home, and we need that miracle once in a while. When people come together, mile after mile, when you stand up for someone else, everything changes, including yourself. You won't be bored or ignored. It's the coming of the Lord. Unity is the one thing that we can't afford. When you feel New Orleans down in your soul, that trumpet in the morning might make you whole. Cause there will be no rest till we bring the best out of the worst. When those who come last finally come first, not just in dreams, but by any means. When we all move together like kings and queens, we might swing once more down in New Orleans. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white?
Professor Louis.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And that was a little musical poetic ode to the Katrina disaster as broadcast on the January 28th episode of Building Bridges. I want to thank them for allowing us to broadcast parts of their show on occasion. If you want to find out more about their program, you can go to their website, which is www.buildingbridgesonline.org. That's www.buildingbridgesonline.org. You're listening to Labor Express, news for working people by working people, and now we're going to go to tonight's feature segment, an interview with Ahmed Al-Jawari, the North American representative of the Iraq Freedom Congress, the IFC. The IFC is a democratic secularist organization which opposes the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the domination of that country by ethnic and religiously based political forces. The manifesto of the IFC states, "The U.S. war on Iraq has led to the disintegration of the fabric of the civil society in Iraq. This war has unleashed the most reactionary, religious, and ethnocentric forces against the people of Iraq. Daily social, economic, and cultural life has plunged into an abyss. Iraq needs to rebuild its civil society. The security, livelihood, and basic freedom of the people must be maintained, and the right to be informed and free determination of their future regime in Iraq guaranteed." On February 12th, U.S. troops for the umpteenth time raided and ransacked the IFC headquarters in Iraq. The U.S. occupation forces and the puppet government in Iraq have no love for the IFC and its mission and have sought to undermine them at every turn. Yesterday, I had an opportunity to talk with Ahmed Al-Jawari, who's the North American representative for the IFC, by phone at his home in Toronto, where he resides. He had to flee the Saddam Hussein regime back in 95 because of his efforts to organize Iraqi workers, and he lives now in Toronto. We're going to air this interview with him actually in two parts. We're going to air part one tonight. It's actually quite a long interview, and I really want to get to air the whole interview because it's really important. A lot of what he has to say, I think, is extremely important. It is not being discussed anywhere else in the press. So we're going to air part one of the interview tonight, and then we'll air part two of the interview on next week's program. So I started our conversation by asking Amjad to describe the purpose and goals of the Iraq Freedom Congress.
Iraq Freedom Congress is an organization established in 2005. It is an umbrella organization for many other organizations. They are the backbone of this organization is the labor movement or a number of labor unions. Along with that, women organizations, children organizations, youth organizations, and student organizations. It's not in particular just organizations, but individual figures, prominent figures there, some tribal leaders, and so on. The aim of this organization is to establish a government or a state, a secular state, non-ethnic. Looking back at the current situation of Iraq, in which the religious and the ethnic groups or fractions who are in power today and try to identify human or identify Iraq people or divide Iraq people based on their ethnic background or religious background. Iraq Freedom Congress sees otherwise and try to define and identify Iraqis or people based on their human identity. So the whole idea is to establish a secular government where the religious has no interference in this government or in the people's life, beside people who are just identified as human in Iraq rather than being Arabs, Kurds, or Turks. So this is mainly the main idea of Iraq Freedom Congress.
And I don't think that the importance of that mission can be overstated because, of course, you know, mostly what we hear in the media and the mass media is about how Iraq is torn apart by these sectarian divisions, these various religious groupings and so on. And, in the minds of many Americans, they think of the Iraqis as being people that are driven primarily by either religious interest or ethnic interest and so on. So having an organization like yours that's really the leading voice for a secular, non-sectarian vision, political vision for Iraq is extremely important.
Well, it is. In fact, in the past 2 or 3 decades, this is as far as I remember, the starting of the 70s, personally never felt I am Kurd or Arab in Iraq, never felt I am Muslim or Christian or Sunni or Shiite in Iraq. In fact, religious part never existed there. The Kurdish and Arabs are still there, but it was the government. The government had played out in that matter. But the religious part, no. I finished my university. I served in the army for 2 years, and I've never been recognized or defined as a Sunni or Shia. I've never been asked, and even such question was strictly banned in the army in particular, because you are just a human. Like, we were called like we are Muslim there in the country, so we don't have to ask these kind of questions. So basically there was no, I personally never felt that division exist at all. And as I said, finished all these, like finished school, even my daughter, she's 16 right now. My wife finished her school, she got her bachelor there. My brothers, I have 6 other brothers, like all my relatives never felt that religious sect exist in our family, in the society, in the university, in anywhere else. All what happened is just like came and become part of the Iraqi society today is just after the war, after 2003, when the, actually before that in 2002, where in London meeting, when the Iraqi fractions or oppositions had a meeting in December 2002, prior to the war, and they decided that Iraq is divided into such groups and divided into such religions, and therefore those religions or those sects must lead Iraq, and they represent Iraq, thinking that Iraq is not a united country, is not a united people, but these are people who are fighting each other in the past, and they keep fighting, and the only way to have them settled is to give everyone a share of power and put them there and establish an Iraq, what they call it, mosaic or something like that, is a diversity, representing the diversity of Iraq. However, this plan has failed miserably and showed us in the last 5 years how Iraq has been torn apart and how the power sharing never been successful. In fact, it was a disastrous to Iraq and created sects within the country itself.
That's a good point, as you point out, that you know so much of this division that's happened either on ethnic or religious lines is something that's happened since the war. It's happened since the occupation of Iraq.
Well, it is in 2003, as I said, I just mentioned earlier, it happened when every group or every sect began to realize itself, began to have the money flowing into its pocket, and began to create its militia. And for this, because of that, we saw that each sect wanted to empower itself against the other sect, and all of it has become about power, about money, about treasure, about nobody of these guys have felt or worked even 1 minute for the people, the ordinary people, who have been suffering since 1968, when the Ba'ath Party took over the power, until this very moment. Those groups who came to power like 5 years ago, or six, it's 5 years ago, never worked for those people. And as we see, the social, infrastructure is still damaged, the electricity, water, healthcare, education, everything has plunged down and is going deeper, is plunging more and more over the 5 years. And the only people who are benefiting from this power sharing are the people who are in the green zone, enjoying all kind of protection, all kind of treasures, and even their families. You see, they are not in Iraq even. They are outside of Iraq, living in Europe or in the United States. They go for a visit, but the ordinary Iraq have been suffering. And they are, in fact, they are the, there's a term we call it in Iraq, they are the gas of this fire. So the ordinary people is the gas of the fire that they have created, those sects created because over the power sharing. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Labor Express, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. In our interview with Ahmed Al-Jawari, the North American representative of the IFC, that's the Iraq Freedom Congress, you heard Amjad describe there how U.S. occupation forces have actually supported and emboldened actors in Iraq who wish to pursue the most narrow of ethnic and religious interests. At the same time, the occupiers have done everything they can to frustrate the work of the IFC. In this next segment, Amjad talks about the most recent round of attacks on the IFC headquarters in Baghdad.
And of course, while the U.S. occupation forces have empowered and emboldened those groups, they've done nothing but try to frustrate your guys' efforts. And of course, the reason I called you particularly today was because I want to talk to you about the most recent attack on the headquarters of your organization by the U.S. occupation forces. I think it was February 12th, right, that they attacked once again the headquarters?
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, IFC is growing in numbers and is gaining more social base in the Iraqi society, given the fact that the most of the, actually all of the sectarian powers or fractions and the ethnic fractions have done nothing for the people in the last 5 years, have created a lot of havoc with the support of the U.S. occupation, of course. Because of that, and we did we do have like the TV started to launch to broadcast beginning of last March, March of last year. What happened is we've been confronted. Actually, we've been confronted by the U.S. occupations a number of times. That was in the past in the last year. This is in what happened on February 12th. It wasn't the first one, and it wasn't the last one, by the way. It wasn't the last attack, actually. In the last 3 weeks, I just called today, just at 12 o'clock this afternoon, Eastern Time. I called the headquarters. Actually, nobody was answering, and I called a number of my comrades there in the IFC, and they told me that last night was the in the last 2 weeks we had two more raids, and last night was the was the last one or the second one. U.S. troops went inside the headquarters. They destroyed almost everything. Mm-hmm. Humiliated the guards, and what happened is they told the guards that we are operating illegally in this country. This is what they told them. Currently, we possess a number of guns. I mean, the AK-47. This is to protect the headquarters, and it is issued by the government legally to us. What they did is they looked for a permission to possess those guns. They gave them. I mean, the guards gave them the permissions, the written permissions. They looked at them and they said, okay. So what they did is they took away the ammunition. So they left the guns, but they took away the ammunition. And they said, you guys must close down this headquarters because it is illegal. And this is the last thing that, this is the last time we tell you, because we're going to arrest everyone here. What they did also, they whatever banners we have, whatever pictures we have, everything, they just destroyed them. The good thing is our TV headquarters, where we, the studio, let's say, we do have it in the, we used to have it in the headquarters, but since the February 12th, what we did is we moved everything from there. So good thing is much of the studio is being transferred somewhere else, not to be taken, because we know very well if it's not going to be taken, they will destroy them, or they will try to, you know, confiscate them. By all means, and they won't give them back to us. And it is a lot of money in there. So What I was told this morning when I called, they said this is the situation right now, and we have decided to close down the headquarters as a building, but we will try to operate within the neighborhoods, or not operate, actually. We have to establish houses in the neighborhoods where actually the raid is going to be minimized, or the effect of the raid is going to be minimized. Unlike now, we cannot operate freely. Even though we said that our organization is we believe in civil resistance. We don't believe in violence at this present time, but still we cannot operate. So this is the final raid that, or the final message that we got from the occupation troops. In fact, there is no other reason but just because we are denouncing the occupation and we are demanding the full withdrawal from Iraq. And we said that we're going to launch a number of a strike all across the country, from Basra to the northern Mosul. They seem not to like the freedom of speech, as they say always, and they want to close us down. In fact, as I said, we are closing our building, just the building, not the organization. We are closing our building. However, we will keep operating among people. We will keep operating among the workers, among women, among youth and students, and even children.
Hmm. What now? When they come and they raid the offices and they harass you and so on, what's the excuse that they give for why they're doing this? I mean, clearly they're interested in shutting you down. They're not interested in hearing your message. That's clearly what's going on here, I think. But what excuses do they offer for why they're doing?
Well, the only excuse, first of all, they were in the beginning. They were saying, well, we believe that they think that they believe there is an illegal activity going on in this from this headquarters. They inspected the house a number of times. They searched a number of times, and they didn't find anything. In fact, we don't have anything but paperwork, and that's it. I mean, some print, small. I've seen it last November. I was there. We had a small printer. We do have one computer, and anyone could have an access to that computer. It's not like even protected by password or anything, because we don't have anything to hide, right? Mm-hmm. So anyone can have an access to that computer. We do have a printer there. We do have like a number of desks and some chairs. Nothing in there, and there are some banners are hang up on against the wall. So there is a small kitchen there where you go. Well, they cook for the visitors or guests who are visiting the headquarters. So they searched that building. It's a two-stories building. They couldn't find anything a number of times, and every time this is the excuse that we believe that there is an illegal activity is operating from this house. Well, after they don't find anything, and as I said for numerous times, so now since February 12th they began say that. You guys are illegal in this country, operating illegally. And by saying illegally, it's vague name, because accusation, because a number of, numerous numbers of organizations are operating in Iraq without any legal permission. I mean, the official or technical permission that you have to go to Ministry of Interior, and they will give you a permission to operate there. This has never happened in Iraq and never been in Iraq, but the troops are saying, well, we are illegally operating here. So that was in February 12, and that was like a week ago, and that was last night or yesterday. They were saying the same thing. You should close down your headquarters, because you guys are operating illegally. You don't have permission to operate. So get the permission and then operate there. And in fact, the government wouldn't give us, even if we apply for it, the government wouldn't give us any permission. We know very well. So it's just a matter of, okay, we don't want you here because you are against us. This is the clear message that we got throughout all the raids that we had in the past.
So basically, I mean, they may not say it in those terms, but they're basically banning your organization is what they're doing. The U.S. occupation forces are basically placing a ban on your organization, really.
In fact, this is this is the final message that we get. Like they say, they didn't say it explicitly, but from the practice, yes, they are banning our organization. And every time we do have, when we have an event or we do have like an incident happen or any functions we are thinking of doing, we will see them right either before that function or after that function. What happened in last time, I think I remember in October, I was there. They went to the headquarters and they did the same thing, absolutely. They attacked, they raided the headquarters just because we were thinking of, we decided to launch a campaign against the draft oil law. Mm-hmm. So that was actually, the raid was prior to that because I remember we sent that letter to the government and we told them, and we said we declared that there we were going to have a day of strike over this issue, and we are against the draft oil law, and we are going to launch a campaign. So at that moment, they realized that, okay, these guys are not stopping what they're doing. So what they did is they raided the headquarters at that time, and they kept raiding it and raiding it every time we do have a function. Basically, we are the only organization. The problem they are seeing right now, we are the only organization in Iraq that operates against the occupation in a nonviolent way. Mm-hmm. So they don't have any evidence against us, and these are just like a very poor, weak evidences they are bringing every time they came to us. And finally, they had nothing to say but, okay, you guys are don't have permission to operate. Basically, the clear message we get, okay, we don't want you here. You are. We don't want you to talk or to speak against the occupation. We don't want you to speak against the government that is in power today. You guys are jeopardizing the position of this government. This is the message that we are clearly getting at every rate.
You're listening to Labor Express, news for working people by working people, in our interview with Ahmed Al-Jawari, the North American representative of the IFC, that's the Iraq Freedom Congress. I asked Amjad to respond to the U.S. media's seemingly uncritical support of the supposed successes of the Bush administration's so-called surge strategy in Iraq.
Now, the press in the U.S. right now is talking a lot about the so-called success of the surge, you know, that the this surge of U.S. troops has brought greater security to Iraq and that violence has gone down and so on and so on. What is your perspective? What's the perspective of your organization on the current state of things in Iraq?
Oh, okay. In terms of this surge is meant, in the beginning, they asked for increasing a number of the U.S. troops on ground. And this is what they did. Actually, they sent, I think, 30,000 troops to Iraq to bring down the violence that is happening in there. What happened is they made some agreements or some deals with those, what they call them, the Sunni Arabs, to give them a share of power. This is in the government. So they gave them the money, they empowered them, and today what they call them the Awakening Council, they do have more than 80,000 members as a Sunni group or Sunni power who were blessed and empowered by the occupation. On the other hand, what happened is Muqtada al-Sadr put his troops on hold for 6 months, and he renewed it just recently to another 6 months. So basically the surge had nothing to do, or sending the troops had nothing to do with the sectarian violence today. As I said, these guys were empowered, and these guys were put on hold. On the other hand, what happened here, this is what I saw in last October. What happened is, yeah, exactly, the sectarian violence decreased in Baghdad, minimized in Baghdad. However, it's been increased in different parts of the country. You see, in Basra, still today, I got information in Basra today, so many people on the sect base were killed or assassinated just recently. In Diyala, which is the northeast of Baghdad, where the Al-Qaeda run after Baghdad, they went there, and the today, it's 60 kilometers northeast of Baghdad, the sectarian violence is very strong there, and so many people got killed. Along with that, just recently they found a mass grave where a number, huge number of women were killed and buried there in Basra because they were women only. Kut, Diwaniya, Nasiriya, Hilla, those cities, with the violence is still strong there, and the in Kirkuk, this is the same thing. Arabs, Kurds, it's like Arab, Kurds, Turks, their assassination is going on very strong. In Baghdad itself, the sectarian violence, as I said, it's minimized. However, the number of booby traps, number of suicide bombers is still in there. And there is a new report saying that February, the number of casualties in February has been doubled as opposed to January. So basically, the surge that what the media is talking about and the big, huge propaganda about it did nothing, and it wasn't fruitful. It was fruitful just in Baghdad, where the sectarian violence minimized. However, the bombing, suicide bombers, and the same violence and the casualties there are still the same, and is in the rise. And basically, what we think as Iraqis, what we think here, based on the number of people who are fleeing the country today, they are saying that there is something is going to happen in the future. We don't know what exactly or how exactly is going to happen, but we feel that because from what they see is that empowering those Sunni Arabs and putting those Muqtada al-Sadr guys on hold, they think that this something is going to, you know, transpire between those guys, and there will be a huge sectarian violence. It's going to be stronger than before. So the number of people who are fleeing the country is doubled this month as opposed to the months that in December and November. Mm-hmm. Besides that, the propaganda is talking about that a number of refugees are going back to Iraq, and they think this is because of the surge. In fact, this is not the reason. What happened is Syria doesn't want to give them, doesn't want to extend their residence there, so they can't find job there, so they must go back. They have nowhere else to go. So what happened is they go back to Iraq, and then they come back to Syria. So this is what has happened, and the number of people or the refugees who are coming back, actually, in fact, they are going back to just to come back to extend their residence in Syria. To do that in Jordan, it's very hard actually to survive there. It's very expensive. You go to Turkey, there is a language barrier. They cannot be there. So the easiest way, or the easiest place to be, is Syria. So and the easiest, like, is the cheapest way to live is Syria. So basically, the propaganda try to tell us that, okay, the situation is getting better. In fact, it doesn't get any better, and the people have a huge fear or strong fear that something is going to transpire in the very near future.
You know, another criticism I've heard, too, from critics of the war and critics of the surge is that they'll say that, you know, yeah, the violence may be down in Baghdad, but a big reason for that is the fact that what the U.S. occupation forces have largely done is allow a lot of ethnic cleansing to happen and then created kind of walled neighborhoods that are, you know, one ethnicity or another. So people are kind of living almost within fortresses, you know, that have already been ethnically cleansed. So it's not surprising in a way that, yeah, maybe in those areas the violence is less than it was before.
Well, in fact, what happened is this is what I saw. Like every neighborhood, well, they call it the hot neighborhood. What they did is they surround those hot neighborhoods with a huge wall, just like the ones that in between Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. just a very huge wall. You cannot actually cross these walls because these are concrete and high. You cannot even climb on these walls. So they did put those walls, and what they did is put like a checkpoint at every wall so those people cannot go freely. And as I said, it is just like most of those people who are there, in fact, they are not Al-Qaeda. In fact, they are the Sunni Arabs, and they cut the deal. Like, actually, the occupation has cut a deal with them to work with the occupation rather than being against the occupation. And we see, like, in Adamiya, this is the huge neighborhood, where they thought that the Al-Qaeda is operating there. In fact, it was operating there, but it wasn't mainly Al-Qaeda. It was another Sunni Arabs. In Al-Amriya, on the other side of the Tigris, or the western side of Tigris, the Sunni Arabs were there. In Al-Dora, which is in the west side of Tigris, there were Sunni Arabs. They were Al-Qaeda, absolutely, but mainly was the Sunni Arabs. And what happened is, as I said, they cut the deal with those guys to be against the Al-Qaeda. And what happened is they kicked Al-Qaeda members from there. However, they are still there. Those Sunni Arabs or the Awakening Council, they are still there. They operate freely, and they are waiting for the time for the power sharing, and they will look at their share in power. They will look at their share in the government, and if they were not satisfied, they would launch another attack or another offensive against the government, against the U.S. troops, against the occupation troops, and the against the Al-Sadr group. And this is what is happening. I mean, this is just a cycle, a matter of just, okay, restructuring, regrouping, and we're going to restart again our offensive and restart again our violence.
You're listening to Labor Express Radio, and that was our interview with Ahmed Al-Jawari, the IFC's representative in North America. That's the Iraq Freedom Congress. As I said earlier in the program, that's part one of our interview with Amjad. We'll have part two of our interview on next week's program, so definitely tune in for that. In that half of the interview, Amjad talks about the IFC's opposition to the draft Iraq oil law. It's an attempt to privatize Iraq's oil resources. And he'll also talk about his take on this year's presidential elections in the United States in regards to whether or not they'll lead to an end of the war in Iraq. And I think, as you might guess, he's somewhat pessimistic about that view. We'll hear about that on next week's program as well. I also want to point out that you can get more information about the Iraq Freedom Congress. They definitely need the support of activists here in the United States. You can go to their website, which is ifcongress.com, ifcongress.com. Not .org. If you go to .org, you won't get there. ifcongress.com is the Iraq Freedom Congress's website, where you can support them in a whole variety of ways. So definitely check that out. They definitely need the support of the labor movement, of activists here, of working people here in the United States. And also, I should mention, of course, that we have some anti-war protests coming up here in Chicago as well, March 19th and March 20th. That's Wednesday, March 19th and Thursday, March 20th. There's going to be rallies here in Chicago. On the 19th, there's a 6 p.m. rally in Federal Plaza, which is at Adams and Dearborn in downtown Chicago. They're going to march from there to the Gold Coast. I find that an interesting idea. And on March 20th, there's going to be a whole variety of different actions apparently happening throughout the city with a convergence at 5 p.m. at Federal Plaza. That's Thursday, March 20th. If you want more information about the protests that are happening here in Chicago on the 19th and 20th against the war in Iraq, go to the website that's been put together for these actions. It's called chicagomassaction.org. Again, that's chicagomassaction.org. And definitely get more information on that. And lastly, if you are really anxious to hear this whole interview now, you don't want to wait for that part two for next week. I've done kind of something unusual this week here, which is I've actually posted the entire interview beginning to end, actually largely unedited, up on my blog, which is pilsenprole.blogspot.com. The easiest way to get to my blog is to go to the Labor Express website, laborexpress.org. Again, that's www.laborexpress.org. And in the middle of the homepage on laborexpress.org is a link to my blog, which is pilsenprole.blogspot.com. If you click on that, the first entry on my blog right now is a posting of the full interview with Amjad Al-Jawahiri. So if you really want to hear the whole thing now, you don't want to wait till next week, you can go to the website and listen to it right now. But I definitely encourage you to tune in next week. It'll be good to hear the rest of that interview, as well as whatever else we're going to have on next week's program. I don't know exactly what else will be in the rest of the program, but there will be more material on the program as well. That's all for tonight's program. Definitely check out our website, www.laborexpress.org, to find out more about the organization's issues and people discussed here on Labor Express Radio. Labor Express is a nonprofit affiliate with IBEW Local 1220. The views expressed on Labor Express are those of its producers, not necessarily those of IBEW. Labor Express is a production of the Committee for Labor Access in Chicago, the world capital of the labor movement. Tune in again next week at 7 p.m. for another edition of Labor Express.